You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Nicole Kobe is a technology, transport, and science journalist. She's the Futures Editor at PC Pro and a contributing editor at Wired. Her work has appeared in New Scientist, The Guardian, and Teen Vogue. Her new book is The Long History of the Future, Why Tomorrow's Tech Still Isn't Here. And here's a picture of it. Nicole, one of the great songs of the 20th century is definitely by the Rolling Stones, You Can't Always Get What You Want. I think the theme of this book, or one of the many themes of this book, is you don't always know what you want. And that's very important when it comes to how we've foreseen the future and foreseen what we wanted, but then arrived to find that maybe we didn't want exactly that.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And I think a lot of the technologies that we really love and rely on, things like smartphones and that sort of thing, you know, if you'd asked me before they came out, was that something I was going to have in my pocket, have in my house all of the time? I would be like, no, I don't want one of those things. That sounds terrible. And now we all have them. So I think sometimes, yeah, there's, you know, there's technology that we would really love to have and we just don't know it yet. And then there's technology that we dream about, things like flying cars. And then when they're presented to us, we're like, ah, that's not actually a great idea. Never mind.
You know, I love the way this book's written. You have a very dry sense of humor that makes reading this a joy. Talk about incorporating a lot, what is clearly a lot of historical and technical research, and then bringing it back with this a nice grin on her reader's face.
So I think that really comes from working in journalism in the UK, because British people don't take a whole lot very seriously. And a large part of my career is working for this magazine called PC Pro. And if you're into computing or technology in the UK, it's the perfect magazine. And everybody who works on it, when we all get together in the pub, which is as often as possible, you know, when I work there, that's just where we lived. We spent the entire time trying to entertain each other and trying to slip jokes into stories. And, you know, it was just this realization that it wasn't just us, it was our readership that really wanted that as well. So a lot of the tech writing in the UK can be a lot more cynical than what you might see in the US. And I think it's often a lot funnier. And I think because I've just spent such a long time working for that publication and kind of in that environment, it really actually came quite easily, because that's just naturally how I write about tech. I think it's fascinating. I think it's wonderful. And I also think it's extremely funny, some of the things that we are working so hard to build. You know, why is flying cars a thing that we are still talking about? You know, I'm not sure anybody's interested in Hyperloop anymore, but why was anybody interested in that? It's, you know, these are some pretty silly ideas that very serious people are putting a lot of time into.
And money throughout the ages. Now, one of the things I really liked about this book was the way it was written and the way it was organized. You essentially take a number, 10 or 12 different kinds of things, visions that we said, yes, we want this in our future, or we've seen them portrayed in fiction, generally science fiction. And then within each, so you tell the stories, the histories of the development of that entire genre of technology. It's flying cars, AI, etc. But I think, and within those stories, you give us lots of fascinating characters, which I really love. And you that dry humor comes through. And one of the things I like is that throughout the book, we see parallels between each of the ways that each of these technologies are developed. But what I liked the most was that you never hammered those in and said, see, this is like this. You let the readers come to that conclusion. And that makes reading the book really fun. You never talk down to the reader.
That is something in my career that I feel I've been very lucky with, is I have always written for publications that are read by people who usually know more about the subject than I do. You know, I'm not a computing expert. I'm not, you know, I'm not an engineer. I don't know how to build things, but I get to interview people and talk to people who know these things. And it takes me, you know, I've got to put a lot of time and effort into learning about these things, which is great because that's what I love about my job. But my readers have always been people that you have to talk up to. I can't condescend to these people. They know the subject so very, very well. And I think that's a more fun audience because you get to get into the nuance of things. You're not just, you know, laying it out in very black and white terms. You get to talk about why something is good and why it might also have bad sides and the history of things and get into all of that. And it's a thing that, you know, thoughtful and having a thoughtful, considerate readership lets you do. So when it came time to write my own book, I knew that's the people who I want to write this book for, is people who don't want to hear, you know, this is good, this is bad, but want to hear, you know, everything about a subject and really dig into why it worked and why it didn't.
You know, that's one of the things that's really interesting in this book is your approach of writing with equal joy about the people who made really bad decisions and some big mistakes, but also people who were brilliant and foresaw things, or people who made great discoveries that worked well, but just didn't meet what we want now in our future. You start out with driverless cars. I will confess, this is something I never wanted.
Yeah.
That said, talk about how one of the things that's true about all of the subjects in this book is that the history of them reaches back pretty far into the past.
Yeah, almost as soon as we built cars, you know, as soon as they started to become a thing that were common on the roads, we immediately realized the problem with cars was the drivers, is we're not, you know, we don't pay attention. We get distracted. We have all these rules about speeds and, you know, you need to stop at this light and stuff, but we don't follow that. The drivers have always been the weak point of cars. And really early on, people started to come up with ideas for how you could, you know, maybe not entirely reduce the driver, but try to sort of, you know, protect them from themselves. And, you know, this goes back to very early days, this idea that you could do like radio controlled cars and things like that. And then it was the 1930s World's Fair. It was like the really, really big one in New York. And a very famous designer called Norman Bel Geddes built this whole vision of what the future cities could look like called Futurama. And it included this idea for driverless cars. And the thing that was really interesting about what he did was he spent the time to understand the technologies that could actually enable this. So the system that he kind of, you know, that he was talking about and he suggested, people were working on in subsequent decades to make, in the belief that they could actually make this work. And one of the ideas was embedding cables and motorways and highways, and then having sensors on the car that would follow that to keep you in your lane. So when you hit the motorway, then you can just take your hand off the wheel and get this really great, you know, kind of cruise control style thing. And that's the sort of thing that we're at now with, you know, level two driverless cars on motorways, things like Teslas, where once you kind of hit that sort of a very structured road, you can let the car drive for you. So we actually had a way of doing that kind of in like the 50s and 60s. It just would have involved embedding a cable in every single road, which would have been very expensive and probably one of the reasons it didn't happen. But we probably by now would have, you know, ripped up those roads to replace, you know, the asphalt and that sort of thing. So we probably could have done it. Here in the UK, they were actually very serious about this idea. They put a lot of research into it, and going through in archives and like reading all these documents, they really truly believe that this is how buses should be run, this is how everything. So this idea, all these ideas that we have now of we could make public transport cheaper and offer a better service if we just automated buses and things like that, This is what they were talking about in the 60s and 70s, and they didn't manage to make it happen. Maybe AI will let it happen now. Who knows? And then it just goes on from there. And there's all these different technologies that have been tried, and they're all so fascinating. And what I love is that they sound bonkers now. Like the idea of having a car that just follows a metal cable, and we're just going to trust that, sounds completely silly to us. But maybe 50 years from now, we're going to look back at, the AI systems that are driving around San Francisco now and be like, well, that was a silly idea. Why did we think that that was going to work? Because we're going to have some technology that's so much further ahead. And that's the kind of the problem with things like driverless cars, is it's hard to be perfect. It's hard to ever get a technology that is going to work. At a certain point, you're just going to have to say, this is the one we're going at. We've got to throw a bunch of money at it and just make it work. And we just have to accept it. Or we just stick with driving or take the bus, which is what I do.
One of the things that I thought was so interesting in this book was how many of the technologies that you talk about actually, came to fruition and sort of worked, and we don't know about it. And that's a really interesting vision of the future as seen from the past, and we're here in the present. This is, this book is a jackpot of steampunk technology.
Yeah, I think one of the things that made me want to write it is I felt like I was writing the same things time after time. I was writing the same headlines like, oh, the UK government announces we're going to have driverless cars on roads this year. And then the next year you write the same story, and the next year you write the same story. And you start to kind of, write these little retro features about, well, here's the guy that had, driverless cars working in the 90s in Germany, and here's what they were doing in the 60s in the UK. And you realize, wow, people have really been working on this for a good long time. And now we feel like we need to rush at these things. And if we take time, I just think the context of all of the history of this is so great. But then, like you say, when you look back at some of the images or you get to see some of the objects from the time, they just look absolutely just bonkers. I mean, one of the first kind of VR AR systems is this huge, massive headpiece thing, and it worked. Like you could interact with a digital object and like go inside it and move it around. And this was before, you really had image-based computing. We didn't have laptops and things like this. The idea of creating this is just absolutely, bonkers that somebody would even try it. And the pictures just look so silly. Like if you showed somebody this now, they'd be like, no, that's not going to work. There's just no way. Yeah, it's just kind of great to look back and get a bit of the context and see how far we've come.
Well, I like the characters too. Bill Gates in particular was wonderful. And back when I was a kid, boy, I must have been about 10 or so, I bought a book called The City in the World of the Future.
That sounds
And
good.
I imagine now that it would be fairly nuts looking. But Bill Gates, as I read about Bill Gates, I'm thinking, my God, he was years ahead of even that book, which was, in the 60s or 70s or so.
Yeah, it's remarkable that these people have such foresight and they can see so far ahead. And there's so many people, in the world of computing and in the world of technology that are just so brilliant at this that they can just see what is going to be happening in 50 or 60 years. And often they think it's going to be much sooner than that. People, when they're working on something, they're always much more optimistic. But I mean, even coming up with things like how artificial intelligence could work before we had functioning computers. I mean, I am not smart enough. My brain is not good enough to do that sort of thing. And I think it just, reading about some of these characters and some of these people, you just get a lot of respect for people who build things and who can engineer a thing, whether that's software development or, building a car or something like that. It's hard to build things. It's hard to pull all of these pieces together and make them work. And these people managed to do it with not knowing what they were even building, really.
That's, I think, one of the really interesting lessons of this book is the gap between imagination and engineering. And you can see why Disney coined the term imagineering. And, you know, one of the things, too, I was thinking, this book made me think science fiction has a lot to answer for. Because we've seen science fiction movies in particular have shown us things that look incredibly realistic. Back in 1939, Fritz Lang's Metropolis gave us a robot that is still with us today. They're still trying to build that damn robot now, what, almost 100 years later. And when I think of, you know, 1982 sitting in a theater and seeing those spinner cars in Blade Runner, they looked so realistic. I just thought, my God, I just want one of those so much. Talk about the gap, you know, and also the connection between the people who would imagine the thing and then the people who would try to build what somebody else imagined or what they imagined themselves.
I think that's a really interesting question, because I think one of the things about, like, any of our kind of, you know, cultural products, whether they're movies or TV or novels or that sort of thing, is we have such a wonderful imagination. And it doesn't matter if it's like sci-fi or rom-coms. I mean, that's not what relationships look like. And we kind of can understand that gap. But when it comes to sci-fi, like you say, people watch it and they're like, well, where's my flying car? You know, why can't I travel like this? And it's like, well, you know, that's not how movies work. That's not how TV works. And we know this. We know that when you watch, you know, Grey's Anatomy, that is not what happens in a hospital. You know, we know this isn't true. I really hope not. But, you know, I think one of the things with sci-fi is it's science fiction is almost kind of a strange wording for it, because it is really about this kind of imagination, about something that we can build. And there's this idea that, you know, all you have to do is build it and it'll be fine. Like, why can't we just build a car that can fly? You know, somebody's like, I know I can't do that, but there's got to be somebody out there who's smart enough to do it. And I'd love that one of the things with this book was I got to talk to people who are working on those projects and have absolutely failed and spent all of their money working on these kinds of things. And they still love it. And they're still so happy to be chasing that dream. But talking about this idea of, like, science fiction to reality, it's not even just science fiction to engineering that's difficult. It's science to engineering. So all of these ideas about a driverless car, or, you know, these so-called flying cars or hyperloops, all of this works, you know, in the lab and on paper, according to physics. These are all sound ideas. They should work. It's just when you put things into the real world, that's when things kind of start to fall apart a bit and you start to realize that it's a bit more complicated out here.
I think, you know, I was listening to what you said, and I think that we should rename the genre of science fiction. It gets a lot of, like, nonfiction help by being called science fiction. It's more accurately future fantasy.
Yeah, and I do think that there's some sort of subsets in science fiction that sort of focus on the sort of futurism side of it more. I mean, I don't even really read a lot of science fiction, and the stuff that I do read tends to be, like, the more dystopian things. So I don't really know what that says about me, and maybe that sort of feeds into some of my cynicism on some of these ideas, is I just see how things could go so terribly wrong. Maybe it's just because I grew up, you know, I was born in Canada. Maybe I just grew up reading Margaret Atwood, and now everything looks like it's going to go to a dark place. So I like that we can explore these ideas and kind of talk about them in science fiction. But I think that some of the problem with how we cover technology as a subject, like in the media, is that we treat things that don't exist yet like they are reality. And we talk about, you know, we talk about artificial general intelligence and the threat that it poses, which is nothing wrong with having that conversation, but it doesn't exist. So we are talking about a thing that we aren't sure we can build. I mean, some people are sure, but we'll have to wait and see. And we don't know what the impact is going to be, because we don't even know how it's going to work. We don't even know what AI technology is going to create it. So we're trying to come up with solutions for something when we don't know what the problems are. We don't know what it's going to look like, and we don't know when it's going to happen. And all of that is going to kind of inform how we're going to deal with these things. And again, it doesn't mean we shouldn't talk about it, but I think we're so used to talking about science fiction and that we kind of blur things together a little bit.
You know, speaking of artificial intelligence, I love your chapter on this. It's really interesting. And you bring up the life of one of the great characters in all of science, Alan Turing. And of course, his famous Turing test was very simple. If you can talk to somebody, essentially to a voice on the phone, and that voice is a voice of a computer, and not be able to tell that, then that's an intelligent being. And I can't tell you, I mean, you know, I've been reading science fiction for 60 years or something, and that definition of artificial intelligence, as soon as I encountered it, I said, well, yep. That sounds about right. Here, all it took was like, you know, 5 minutes of ChatGPT to understand it's not right. And we don't understand it. And, you know, one of the, I think, the big problems with artificial intelligence is we don't have a good definition for actual intelligence. So trying to create an artificial version of it is like trying to make an artificial chocolate milkshake when you don't know what either chocolate or milk tastes like.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I think that all of these AI systems that are coming out, they're really impressive, but they of course have, like anything, they have limitations. And, you know, I just think that sometimes we kind of get caught up in the excitement of a lot of these things. And we forget that, oh, you know, people say things like this AI system is designed to operate like the human brain. And it's like, we don't know how the human brain truly operates. Well, this system can think. We don't know what thinking means. We don't know what human consciousness is. Like, not to get massively philosophical, but like there's entire, you know, academic strings of thought about what all of these words mean and why we have words and why we think about things the way that we do. And I think it's because we have a tendency to use words that we would use to describe ourselves, to describe machines. And that doesn't work because we are incredibly different things. You know, ChatGPT is not thinking at all. It's processing. You know, it's a better way of describing it. Like, you know, when sometimes you think about your computer and it starts to kind of churn a bit. And I always think of that as being like, oh, it's thinking about things real hard, which is a sign I need a new laptop, I think. I know in my head it's not thinking. It's this, you know, this metaphor that we have that isn't a great one. And we should think a little bit more or have a better way of talking about these things. Because people who don't spend a lot of time thinking about this, maybe just read a headline or read a, you know, a story in the newspaper, they think these things are here. They think these machines are capable of thinking. They think that they can write well. And it takes a lot of time and effort to truly understand what is happening with these systems. And the really cool thing about ChatGPT, and like, I will give OpenAI a lot of credit for doing this, when they put it out in the world for us to just use for free, we can see how it works. We can see what it's bad at. We can watch what they're up to and kind of, I don't know, understand it a little, as, you know, kind of be brought along with it, if that makes sense, brought along with what they're doing. And I think that that's a really powerful thing. But I still get people who come up and talk to me because of the book about AI stuff. And I'm like, have you used ChatGPT? And they're like, no, I don't understand tech stuff. It's like, if you open a box and you type into it, you can do this and you can understand the limitations of it and what's fun about it and what's remarkable about it. And that's not a thing that's true of most technologies. Like, most people can't just go to San Francisco and get a driverless car. But most of us can sit down with ChatGPT and have a go with it. So yeah, I think that that's a really powerful thing. And if any of your listeners have not done that, they should, you know, when they're done listening, go do that and poke holes in it and have fun and let yourself be impressed, but also let yourself be disappointed.
You know, you talked about the importance of language and the way we describe things as ourselves or ourselves as machines. It's important to know the history, as you tell us in this book, because the word computer did not originally refer to machines. It referred to the hired women who would do the, you know, the long division for the, you know, the early iterations of NASA. And only later was the word applied to a machine when computers, as we now know them to be, became capable of that kind of advanced math. The first, you know, computers were, as you point out, the size of, you know, a schoolroom, and able to not do too much.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you talk about sort of the, you know, the female history of tech. You know, there was a point where there was more women working in computer science and computing because it was a relatively low-end job, and it was something that it's okay for a woman to sit at a desk with a notepad and a pencil. We were okay with that. But even once we started building these big machines, and at that point, they were just so expensive, and they were war machines. They were very much about, you know, calculating how to drop bombs on people and all that sort of thing. But one of my favorite stories is the ENIAC machine, which was used to calculate artillery. And I don't know, I'm not a militarily minded person, but it, every single time that you used it, you had to reprogram it, which involved like pulling out wires and like physically moving bits around, because it wasn't digital. It was like a physical computer. And the way that they kind of wrote the calculations and what they were going to do with it was women sat down and wrote this out on paper. These amazing mathematicians would sit and write this out, but they weren't allowed in the room with the machine, so they never saw it. They saw blueprints for it, so they had to write for the system that they weren't allowed to be anywhere near. And I can't even imagine trying to picture that in your head and come up with, you know, different ways of using a system that you weren't even allowed to see. It's such, you know, just because they were worried about spies and all that sort of thing. It's just, you know, an absolutely fascinating time in computing history.
Well, it's also really fascinating, this book that lays out a history that takes a very winding path between science, engineering, and manufacturing and making money. Yeah. Because many of these things were realized, but then they realized, oh, God, maybe people don't want to pay $20,000 in 1956 for a flying car.
Yeah, and I think the flying cars is so interesting, because when I do events or anything for this book, the one thing people come up is they're like, well, where's my flying car? And I'm like, okay, so let's just get this out of the way. We had them. We called them, you know, rotable aircraft. You know, flying car is a very wonderful and sexy term.
But I love the idea, the flivver.
Yes. But like, it was just this idea of having this vehicle that you could drive to the airport and you could order the airfield or wherever you were taking off and take off and go fly wherever you wanted to go, and then land, you know, do whatever you need to do to convert it back into a car and drive off. And that's not really the dream of the flying car. That's not, you know, that's not what we want. What we want is a car that we can take off from our house, or we see traffic ahead and we just take off, you know. We don't have to drive to an airport. If I have to drive to an airport, why don't I just drive to an airport and then get in a plane? Is the thing that I have never really understood about this design. But they came up with, all of these amazing designs. And the problem was, because of safety regulations around cars, in a lot of ways are tighter than planes. So you had to have safety regulations for both vehicles. So you had to meet an aircraft spec and you also had to meet an automotive spec, and that's very difficult. So some of the designs were actually for three-wheeled vehicles that managed to squeak into a motorcycle designation. So then you could, you know, not worry about safety quite as much. Which meant that these things weren't very good for flying. They were very slow. They were very clunky. Some of them actually had, you know, like a separate engine for both. You had a car engine and the plane engine, which means you're now carrying a car engine with you everywhere you go. All these sorts of ideas. And then when you're driving a vehicle that has to have a way of hooking wings and a tail onto it. And some of them, they had these great ones where they would like fold out, or it might just be a trailer. So now you're just hauling a trailer with you everywhere. So it's clunky and uncomfortable as a car. It's heavy and slow as a plane. And like you say, you know, the first one that was certified was like 1956 or something, the Aero car. And it was certified. They did sell a couple of them. But it cost, you know, $15,000, $20,000. At the time when you could buy a nice car for $2,000, a nice plane for $2,000, why would you do this? You know, and you get into, once we manage to manufacture them enough, that'll help bring the cost down. Yeah, maybe, but they didn't manage to sell enough to even get to that point. So, and I don't think it's too much of a surprise that that it didn't go into general production.
You know, one of the things that I really loved were some of these really kind of wild characters that you talk about. There was one of the fellows who was trying to do virtual reality, Palmer. What was his name? I keep wanting to say Palmer Luckey.
Oh, Lucky Palmer.
Yeah.
He's fascinating, and he's so interesting because he just did it out of sheer love for the idea and
He was really
belief that,
smart too, my God.
and he just bought every existing like VR gaming hardware. He just bought all of it. Every single piece. He had probably the best collection in the world at some point of all these just little bits and pieces of, gaming headsets and whatever that weren't very good. So they had very limited field of vision. The way that I had it described to me was, when you're a kid and you get like the toilet paper rolls, the little cardboard ones, you just tape them together. It's kind of like looking through those. So it's not very much fun, for people who are used to playing on like multiple monitors and things like that. And he just knew he could make it better, but his way of understanding how the systems work was to buy all of them, kind of take them apart, because his job was to fix phones, so he was quite comfortable taking tech apart and putting it back together again, and that he just learned so much from it. And the ideas that he came up with, of doing the split screen instead of having two screens, just doing it digitally, is such a simple, beautiful solution. Like, it just solves this problem that people couldn't solve. And he's just this kid living on his parents' driveway in a trailer playing with games, is great. It's great. He's a wonderful character. I mean, he's definitely like a character, but.
You know, one of the things that you talk about is that you not only have to battle the tech, you also have legal battles too, in terms of, competition and also in terms of, getting stuff that out there that's safe. You know, some of these things that are put together are, patently unsafe, and the people who put them together know it. Sometimes, tragically, we just heard this morning an article about the fellow who created the Titan submersible that collapsed. I mean, he was told, "Don't do that," and he's very prideful, and the article was about the different kinds of pride that inspires you and pride that inspires you to do stupid things. And he was a little on the ladder. Talk about that kind of interplay between tech and legality.
So one of the things with the way that we look at the tech industry is there's a sort of idea of like the genius creator who, comes up with all of this stuff on their own, and they take risks and they're bold and they're not like the rest of us. It's kind of like that they're very special people. So I think that people kind of who work in this area can really get it in their heads that everyone who is saying no to them is just wrong, and that they will be able to overcome all of these things and it will all be fine. But that's why we have regulators. That's why we have safety rules as all of this. So I've spent a fair amount of time kind of covering like these so-called flying cars, because the modern ones are not in any way flying cars. They're just kind of electric helicopters, and maybe even just an entirely new type of aviation. You're not going to land it on your driveway for sure. And if you work in aviation, even if you're trying to disrupt the market, you will always, especially when you're talking to a journalist, you will always, always, always talk about the importance of regulation and how keen you are to work with regulators. Because if you have a crash, you're done. Your company is just done. If you do anything that is seen as risky, aviation is just so, so risk averse. And that creates problems because these technologies are all so new. that, you know, you're kind of coming up with new stuff all of the time. And that means you've got to go back in the certification process and you've got to start this bit over again and so on. And these certification processes take years and years and years. And at that point, you know, parts of the technology might be out of date. So we do need to find ways for regulators to not be holding back, you know, innovation in new areas. But there is no point of in innovating or rushing innovation if it's going to just lead to, you know, the market falling apart because everyone's scared of it. You know, if we get too many driverless car crashes, people are not going to get in these things. If you built a Hyperloop and it immediately led to a crash, no one's going to buy tickets. Like you are hurting your own market if you don't come across as safe and you don't come across as trustworthy. And we know that those are huge issues in technology in Silicon Valley anyway. But one of the problems with the technology industry is it sees regulators inherently and always talks about regulators as holding things back and slowing things down and slow, you know, putting a brake on innovation. And you know, sometimes that's probably true, but I mean, if you ran a technology company, you're never going to be like, yeah, we're happy with the pace of regulators. You're always going to be pushing them to move faster and to give you more space because that's what you do. That's what you hired those lobbyists to do, is to make that argument. So we need to make sure we have regulators that understand when they're going too slowly and can withstand all of this pressure when they should be standing up and slowing things down.
I love the history of robots. Especially, it was fun to read about Shaky again. I remember reading about Shaky back in the day, but Shaky is a robot that had that was both comical and consequential. And I think that's one of the things we find in this book. So much we read about is funny at the time and dismissed, yet in the long run, it turns out to have, a big cash bang somewhere down the line.
Yeah, and the Shaky robot, so it was created at this organization called the Stanford Research Institute, which is like a spin-out of Stanford University, sort of like
SRI.
sort of like they commercialized the things coming out of Stanford University, which obviously there's a lot because it's, you know, such an impressive school. And SRA is sort of infamous for coming up with these ideas and not commercializing themselves. They just sort of hand them off or license them or sell them or whatever. My favorite examples is iPhone's Siri, like that voice assistant, initially came out of SRI Labs, as apparently did Tide Pods. You know, the if you're doing laundry and you get the little plasticky kind of rubbery pods that people are always worried that children are going to eat for some reason. Those apparently are also an SRI invention. Now, obviously, SRI is not producing laundry detergent, but they come up with these ideas and they just explore them. And it's just such an interesting way of innovating and of coming up with ideas, just getting a bunch of smart people in a room and kind of rolling with it. And that with Shaky is exactly what they did, is the robot itself. You can go see it at the, it's like Computing
Museum.
History Museum.
Yeah, I have a relative who works there.
Do you? It's such a great museum. And
I've been
you
there.
go
It's
look.
wonderful.
But like the robots, there's all these impressive robots, like humanoid shapes and like really remarkable things. And then the actual most impressive robot, I mean, it looks like, I don't know, a broken appliance. Like it's just this big box with wires sticking out of it. It just, you know, it looks like a piece of junk. And I mean, to an extent, it kind of was, because the robot itself wasn't the important thing. It was the AI, and they're pulling together all of these autonomous systems, you know, inventing computer vision systems, coming up with navigation systems that are, you know, still inherently how we power sat nav, like the core ideas and all of that. You know, algorithms that are still, you know, in use today. And this is from the late 60s, early 70s, and they eventually had to shut down the project because they couldn't get enough money for it. It's just amazing. But all of the people who worked on it are, you know, just like luminaries in the field. Like they all went on to do absolutely amazing things. But I didn't know a whole lot about the project when I started writing the book. And yeah, I'd heard about it, but I didn't know that much about it. And I think it was my favorite thing to research because everyone involved with it just had, like, when they talk about it, when you see like interviews and, you know, recorded interviews and stuff with them, they just glow talking about it. Like they're just still so excited about it. And the guy who sort of initiated and ran the project, Charlie Rosen, sounds like such a joy. Like he did everything to like lift up his staff and like help them in their careers and, you know, believed in coming up with like all of these ideas to like help, you know, make the world, you know, better and to move technology on. But he also had like clearly just a really funny sense of humor. So there's a really great video that, you know, was very famous at the time that's Shaky working. It's them typing in the instructions to it and it goes about its, you know, its process and makes decisions about what to do, which is completely remarkable to have a robot making decisions. We don't really have humanoid robots doing that now. Like it's still such a remarkable thing to do. And there's this scene in the video, and you can go watch this on YouTube, where he is dressed up in like a Halloween costume and jumps in front of the robot to kick one of the boxes, you know, into its way, just to show that it can, you know, think on the fly and come up with a new route. You know, he didn't need to go get a Halloween costume to do this. He didn't need to dress up. The robot isn't looking at him. He did it just because it was funny. And he's credited at the end of the video as the gremlin. Like that's like it just looked like such a fun project to work on, and they just did all of this amazing work. And you know, I didn't even really know about it. And I think it's projects like those that I think are so worth, you know, reminding people of and getting those stories out. Because they're just fascinating and just really, really fun.
You know, one of the things that what you were just saying made me think that when they were getting people together to try to create an advanced technology, often the technology that is most impressive that comes out of these projects is not the piece of metal or the wonderful car, but the way the people have to figure out to work together and create these new technologies that. It's the human technologies too that's really important in this book, and there's just such a wonderful variety because there are, you know, there's a guy I really like, Jaron Lanier. I mean, he's a guy who grew up in a geodesic dome. He built himself at like what the age of 12 and had lives in a like a gourd almost. Talk about the human technology and also Jaron Lanier.
Yeah, I mean, he's really, really fascinating. You know, he built this headset, you know, this VR headset that worked perfectly well. Kind of like late 80s, early 90s. It was just too expensive and it was too heavy. That I mean, that was the only thing that was wrong with it. He just needed technology to catch up, you know, a little bit and a little bit more money and a little bit more time. And then he'd be the one whose name everybody knew, and we would have had these amazing VR systems even earlier. But he's one of those people that just they're very creative thinkers. They think about things in a, you know, a thousand different ways. I mean, he's written many, many books, which like are just fascinating to read. And a lot of them talk about his life and just the way he thinks about technology, less than the technology itself. So he wrote this one book that's, forgive me, I can't remember the exact name of it, but it's a kind of a memoir about how he built this VR system. And he does talk about the technology and how they overcame some of that, but it's more talking about, you know, his way of thinking and how he kind of approached these things and his inspiration for things, which is such an interesting thing to hear about from somebody who has such a different way of thinking and who managed to achieve so much. Because he really, you know, he doesn't think like most people do. And even now he's writing about like, you know, the negative impacts of social media on us and all of that sort of stuff. Like he hasn't stopped thinking about all of these technology ideas, even if he isn't inventing headsets anymore.
You know, speaking of augmented reality, one of the first time I ever heard the quote from William Gibson that really applies to this book, which is "The future has arrived, it's just not evenly distributed," was when I spoke to him about a book I think called Spook Country, which was in which people wore special glasses to see different art exhibits that were out in all over the place. And the augmented reality is a fascinating chapter. It's just so funny because, as you said, I mean, Who really wants to see the world through two toilet tubes?
Yeah, I mean, the idea behind augmented reality is an interesting one because it's something. So one of the people I interviewed for the book is Sebastian Throne, who used to work for Google. He did all of the kind of driverless car stuff, and then Google Glass was one of the projects he worked on. And the idea that they had was, you know how you, like, you keep putting your hand in your pocket to pull out your phone, you know, to check directions if you're going somewhere, to check your messages because you felt it buzz, all of that sort of thing. What if you didn't have to pull it out? What if, you know, you're just walking around and, you know, I wear glasses anyway, and it just said, oh, go that way, or a message just popped up and you didn't have to pull your phone out. Now, personally, I don't mind pulling my phone out. And I like the fact that when I put my phone back in my pocket, it's not in front of my face anymore. So they're trying very hard to create these technologies, you know, so we don't have to look at screens all the time. But to me, it sounds a lot like we're going to be looking at screens all of the time. So I think it's one of those things where they're building a thing truly believing that this is going to be the next form of computing. And I personally don't buy it. I mean, I wear glasses anyway, so fine. But if you don't wear glasses, why would you wear glasses just so you can see if, you know, you got a WhatsApp, you know, just don't. And if you don't want to stare at a screen as much, that is a bigger conversation we need to be having about how maybe we can leave our phones in our pockets, or, you know, maybe leave our phones at home when we go out and crazy. I mean, I get lost a lot, so I'm not leaving my phone at home. But, you know, if we think that staring at phones is the problem, maybe we need to rethink how some of these technologies have made us so dependent on them, rather than come up with a technology that is now attached to my face all of the time.
One of the things that's really important when researching a topic or trying to explain it, it's not the answers you get so much as the questions you ask. And you end the book with a chapter titled with a very good question for such a book, which is, who builds the future? What did you find out when you researched that, sought an answer to this question?
I didn't initially intend to finish with that question. That was sort of something that came out while I was working on the book. I knew I wanted to do a conclusion that kind of pulled all of the kind of threads from the book together and sort of talked about what next and how should we be looking at building the future. But I, you know, I didn't have a really solid way of looking at it yet. And I think it really just came out of, you know, you're reading all of this research and it's very clear who's not included in these stories. And it's very clear that, you know, the people who were building the future, in particular in the US in the 50s and 60s, was men of a certain education level. And that's fine. I mean, they built amazing things and that's great. But maybe some of these problems that they found insurmountable could have been solved if we had a wider range of people in the room. And, you know, just throughout my career, I've had so many times that I've been sitting in a room listening to a startup founder or, you know, the CTO of some company, and they're talking about something and I'm just like, what? Like, why didn't you include this? Or you seriously didn't think to do this? You know, and it just sort of blows my mind. And, you know, I don't think that you necessarily need to, you know, create a tech industry that is like perfectly reflective of, you know, the local population or something like that. But having a little bit more, a wider range of diversity, and that can be everything from, you know, gender, age, race, country of origin, like education level, anything. But we just need to include more people in these projects and these processes. Because otherwise, a lot of questions don't get answered. A lot of questions don't even get thought, you know, like this idea of coming up with a good question. You know, a lot of these people are not coming up with, you know, any of the downsides, any of the questions that should be asked, let alone coming up with the answer for them. And I think AI is a really good example for that, because if you look at any of the ethics in AI conversation, and it's a vibrant, great conversation. Like, there's some really excellent work that is happening, and it is just predominantly women, and very often women of color, who are asking these questions and bringing these things up. And they're not necessarily in the room at these big companies. They're talking about it from the outside. And I think that they should be included in the room because they have some good ideas and they're saying some good things. The problem is they're being critical. And these really massive tech companies that are, have just billions and billions and billions of dollars coming in every single day are very sensitive. If you say, I think you might have made a mistake here. I think there's something you haven't considered here. Or, you made this claim and I'm not sure that it's entirely true. They get angry. They get very angry. And as a journalist, I've had this happen to me where, like, I'm not going to name names because I don't want to get into that kind of trouble. But, you write something that's even glancingly negative about a project or just point out some flaws with it. And you get a phone call from the PR and they tell you, we're going to need you to change this. You're like, okay, put it in an email, write it all out, all the details, what I got wrong. Because if I've made a mistake in my story 100%, of course I'm going to correct it. Like, thank you for letting me know. But I need you to put it in writing exactly what's wrong. You never get the email. They're just calling you to just bully you. And I had the good fortune of working for editors who think that's very, very funny and are just like, well, if they send you the email, then we'll make the changes, but if they don't, then we won't. But it's hard. It's hard to push back against all of this. So yeah, I think a good range of people always ends in a better result.
Well, you documented more than one case where people spend multiple billions, that's with a B, of dollars buying the rights to a product that made them exactly $0 or just cost them money in addition to purchasing the rights. So I think it does behoove us to get more people and get more perspectives into the situation. And that's one of the things I think that is so valuable about this book is that it speaks to the import of history. I mean, you don't know nothing if you don't know history. You can know all the tech in the world, but if you try to develop a flying car and don't know the history of flying cars that's already there, then you might as well, dig two graves.
Yeah, exactly. And like you say, it's interesting. It's they're good stories. I find it so amazing that you could be doing a job working on driverless cars and not look back to the past mistakes or the past places where people got hung up. People think that because it's a different technology, this is AI instead of, just raw computing or, radar or whatever, that it doesn't apply, that it's different problems. But so often the real challenges aren't necessarily the technology. It's that the money runs out. It's that regulators aren't into it. It's that there's no business case or there's no business model or that, the public sees it and just goes, no, we're not interested in that, even though we said we were, because we're a fickle bunch. And those problems have nothing to do with technology. That's just making a product. That's just manufacturing. That's engineering. There's a lot of lessons to be learned from stuff that happened in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, even if you're using technology that feels a world away.
While machine technology has changed greatly since the 1930s and the 1830s, human technology and the way humans get along has not. Nicole Covey's book is The Long History of the Future: Why Tomorrow's Technology Still Is Not Here. Thank you for joining me, Nicole.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.